Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Ed Fitzgerald's driving record coming under fire.
Turns out he only had a temporary learner's permit when he was mayor in Lakewood and was driving a city vehicle there. In fact, he didn't get his driver's license until November of 2012.
Ohio law requires temporary permit drivers to have a licensed driver next to them when they are behind the wheel, always.
Witnesses say they saw Fitzgerald drive alone multiple times. Ed Fitzgerald kept renewing his learner's permit. Why? We're trying to find out.
That political ad, paid for by the Ohio Republican Party, is called Unfit to Lead. It attempts to capitalize on the recent news that Ohio Democratic gubernatorial candidate Ed Fitzgerald apparently drove without a valid driver's license for a decade. And that news was spawned from revelations of Fitzgerald's role in a two-year-old police report that indicated he had been discovered in the early morning hours in a car alone with a woman who wasn't his wife. Neither revelation is good news for Fitzgerald, but are they enough to take him down, or at least down another notch from where he's at? Today we're talking about the political scandal effect, why some are ruined while others brush them off or are even strengthened. Coming up, we'll hear from scholars who study such things. Joining us now in the studio is someone who covers such things, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Hi, Karen.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And there's never been a shortage of scandals in Ohio.
No, but this is the first one I can think of in a long time that happened during an election. I mean, the last two big scandals that I can recall are Governor Taft becoming the first Ohio governor to be convicted in office.
I see. So you're saying after. Okay.
Right. And that was in 2005. So he was in the second to last year of his term in office, of his second term. And then, of course, the Mark Dan scandal, which happened after he was already elected, the sexual harassment scandal that eventually resulted in ethics violations against him as well. And so those weren't during a campaign, though. And so this is what I think is unique, is we always have during campaigns things that pop up here and there and fires that happen throughout different campaigns. And so you start asking candidates questions about this thing for a couple of weeks, and then eventually these things start to go away. But this one, this is pretty extraordinary. I mean, the police report from October 2012 showing Fitzgerald was in a car with a woman from a delegation of visitors from Ireland. It was 4:30 in the morning, darkened parking lot. There were a lot of questions raised. But then the follow-up question to that, the driver's license question, why did you have a temporary permit for 10 years? That's a question I think a lot of people are asking. And I do a weekly TV talk show that airs here on WOSU called The State of Ohio. And I had two long-time campaign strategists on, a Democrat and a Republican, asking them the same question you started out here. Is this enough to take down his campaign? And, of course, the Republican, Mark Weaver, a longtime Republican strategist, says, yes, he feels that Fitzgerald will just stop campaigning, that in his heart he knows he can't win, and so he will just kind of give up because he'll be dogged by these questions throughout the rest of the year. And the other strategist, Greg Haas, a Democratic strategist, said he feels that this is survivable, but one of the things that the candidate and the campaign has to do is come up with a path to victory, a solid message that shows that we can win this and that we're going forward. And he said he's still waiting to hear that from the campaign.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Today we're talking about the political scandal and why for some it's just an exercise in futility, and for others it's an exercise that makes them stronger. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. My guest right now, Karen Kassler of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If he doesn't win in November, which so far the polls suggest and campaign finances suggest he won't, how much of a loss? How do you measure how much is due to those kinds of reports, those kinds of issues?
I don't know. I mean, certainly the lack of money is a big issue at this point.
And it has been.
It has been. Right. And you just aired an ad from the Ohio Republican Party. The Republican Governors Association has been involved in this campaign. And Fitzgerald even noted in the revelation of that police report that the RGA had actually asked for those public records from the police department back in May. And he suggested that this was a whole dirty politics campaign that the Republicans had been trying to put together against him. And the lack of money or the imbalance between the two candidates. I mean, you've got what, 8-1 almost? Is that what we're at in terms of Kasich versus Fitzgerald in terms of money? That's huge, especially when you're talking about a candidate, Ed Fitzgerald. The last Quinnipiac poll shows 65% don't know enough about him to have an opinion. That's a lot of people who don't know who he is.
And now someone's spending a lot of money making sure they do know something about him.
Right. I mean, the last RGA camp ad came out before all these revelations. It's they described him, though, as risky, as a risky candidate, and brought up some other things from his time as the Cuyahoga County executive. And now this one, of course, from the Ohio Republican Party, really starts throwing onto that with the current revelations. But, I mean, the other question that you have to ask is, you know, this isn't Ed Fitzgerald's first slip-up here. You had the whole situation back last year where he had nominated State Senator Eric Kearney to be his running mate, and then it turned out Eric Kearney had some unresolved tax issues, about $1 million in unresolved tax issues. He was dropped from the ballot. Sharon Newhart was brought in. So this is a second misstep, as some people might see it. And you have columnists and pundits, Brett Larkin from the Plain Dealer in Cleveland, arguing that this is going to take down the entire ticket, that not only is Fitzgerald going to lose, but the rest of the ticket is going to lose. I don't think we can necessarily predict that because there's still 3 months. Who knows what could happen? But like you said, the numbers suggest that it's going to be a tough 3 months at the very least.
At the top of the ticket.
Yes.
Which does portend some things for downstream.
And the other thing, too, is as we talk about the top of the ticket and only the top of the ticket, we're not talking about the other races.
Right.
And there are some candidates who are a little bit frustrated that we're not talking about their races. And I can understand why they're frustrated, but we only have limited resources. We have limited airtime. And this is what people have been talking about to us. The idea that one candidate in the race doesn't have a driver's license really surprises some people.
Yeah, all right. So do we yet know why he drove with a temp for 10 years, off and on for 10 years, or with nothing, apparently?
When our Joe Engels was at a press conference at the Ohio Democratic Party headquarters last week, she asked party chair Chris Redfern, did you vet him? Did you know about this? And Redfern said that he had talked to Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald had told him, and that Fitzgerald had apologized profusely, but said he was a horrible procrastinator. Now, that's an interesting set of words because I think a lot of people can relate to procrastinating. Everybody prioritizes. Everybody has things that they think that they'll get around to eventually. This is one, though, that people just don't tend to procrastinate
on. This is like getting toilet paper.
Well, and especially when a person is a law director, a mayor, a lawyer, a former FBI agent, it's hard to understand. And I think that's maybe where Ed Fitzgerald is right now in terms of having to explain to people how this could have happened. I mean, a functioning adult with a work and life environment and all these things going on, unless you're getting rides from everybody else, at some point, if you don't have a driver's license, aren't you going to break the law?
And that's basically the sum total of the explanation is it was a mistake.
Right.
Was,
and he's apologized over and over for his mistakes. I presume when he says he's apologized for his mistakes, he's talking about the perception mistake with the woman in the car, because he's claimed that nothing happened. He was not cited for anything.
And
know,
the police
situation.
Have confirmed that he didn't jump in from the back seat.
Right,
and
that everybody, there was nothing going on when they approached the car. Mm-hmm. That's what the police are saying. And then Ed Fitzgerald is also apologizing for the driver's license issue. But again, I think there are people who wonder, how does this happen?
Right. And there's a lot of other uses for a driver's license. I'm asked to show my driver's license when I use my credit card sometimes.
Well, and it's actually one thing that Democrats, though, have brought up in the whole photo voter ID situation, that there are a lot of people who don't have driver's licenses because they don't drive. They're retired. Mm-hmm. They're in different circumstances. But then people who are in a circumstance like Ed Fitzgerald, where you're working full time and you have a family with a lot of kids and everything, how can you not have a driver's license? You know, we don't have the public transit systems like they have in New York City. How do you get around?
Now, with enough money, it's possible he could counteract some of this.
Oh, sure.
Because he is getting some name recognition
sure,
out of
absolutely.
This.
Yes.
Certainly, if they did a Quinnipiac poll today, a lot more than 65% would know who he is.
You would think,
would know
yes.
something about him.
Exactly. And certainly, elections are not strictly bought. I mean, Sherrod Brown and Josh Mandel, in the Senate race in a couple years ago, Josh Mandel and his friends outspent Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown still won. And Democrats will point to that and say, just because you have more money doesn't mean you're going to win the election. And that's, you know, but money does help, especially when you're trying to get your name out there or even to try to counteract what's being said about you that you'd like to change.
There's a couple things. Current Attorney General Mike DeWine's been in hot water over pay to play, which is an issue that pops up for every attorney general since the 90s when Tony Celebrezze was first accused of it. In other words, having law firms that do contract work for the attorney general's office also give campaign contributions. It's always been a problem. He's also been questioned about getting personally involved in a sexual harassment case for one of his employees. That story's been confusing and hard to follow.
Yes,
and I was wondering, does that make it hard for an opponent to throw it in his face? There was the CoinGate.
Yeah.
That was pretty easy to understand for most people.
Well, yeah, and the longer
the
that went
Noe.
On, the more the dots got connected. Mm-hmm. This whole sexual harassment situation at the Attorney General's office, you have these two investigations, one from the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office and one an internal investigation, and nothing was ever turned up that was concrete on this. And the question the Democrats are raising, and this is the angle that we've been following, is did Mike DeWine get involved for what was his reasons for getting involved? Mm-hmm. Because the Democrats are saying he got involved to quash this because this was one of his friends mm-hmm. who was committing this alleged sexual harassment. DeWine says he got involved because he wanted to get to the bottom of it. He was concerned for the woman and that's what happened. So it's a very confusing story. And I, you know, David Pepper, who's running against Mike DeWine, he's focused more on, like today he's having an event about heroin and battling heroin. He's focused more on that. But the Democratic Party has certainly been trying to draw attention to the sexual
harassment.
Which
is a very similar relationship between John Kasich and the Republican Governors Association and the Ohio Republican Party. They're taking up the staff against Fitzgerald for these improprieties or these questions, but he can stick to the issues. Then.
Right.
That's,
I think you're going to see that. I mean, even like looking at the treasurer's race, Connie Pillage, you know, she could have brought up the whole Ben Suarez trial up in Northeast Ohio that Mandel, Ben Suarez was a Northeast Ohio businessman who had raised money for Mandel. She didn't bring it up. The Democratic Party did. And so, you know, I think that's the party's kind of playing that role.
Tony in Holmes County, you're on the air. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I think that people will be more voting against Kasich than voting for Fitzgerald just from the things that Kasich has done, like Jobs Ohio, cuts to local government, taking away the 12% the state pays for public schools, the charter schools being run by people from Turkey. The homestead exemption being taken away from people that make over $30,000.
So you're saying that people will
be
voting
against
Kasich. Yeah. And that's probably why Fitzgerald hasn't fallen or has always maintained, even though it's a double-digit separation now,
right.
It's not as bad as others have had in the past, Karen Kessler. And thanks, Tony, for the call. Appreciate it.
I think Tony's right that there is still a very strong anti-Kasich sentiment, and certainly the Democrats were counting on that. I mean, what they did with the Senate Bill 5 campaign a couple years ago was tremendous in terms of organizing their base and getting people excited about this issue, and whether they can do that again and help their candidate who has low name recognition mm-hmm. overcome Kasich, that's going to be a question.
And Kasich has his own problems, but if you can't afford to put the ads on television so people can see them,
right.
For instance, yelling about the State Highway Patrol and who pulled him over, I guess, or a police officer.
Right, the whole cop is an idiot
the cop is
thing
an idiot. Yeah.
from a couple of years ago. Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of things that people can
that
talk about.
That everyone predicted, that's going to pop up in 2014,
sure.
But
Kasich has been running a campaign that's been very low profile in terms of campaigning. Mm-hmm. He's been doing a lot of governor things, but not as many candidate
things.
Well,
that's the luxury of an incumbent.
Absolutely. And so he's been able to escape a lot of these kinds of things being thrown at him. So the question is, we're now approaching Labor Day, and Labor Day, you know, people used to talk about Labor Day being the start of the election season, but now with early voting starting in October, the election season really does start a lot earlier.
To me, it's 24/7, but I guess I'm just because I'm in the business. But
yeah, I think there was a definite thought that whoever the Democratic candidate candidate was going to be an anti-Kasich vote for a lot of people. But I think there was also this issue, and I don't know how many people thought about this, that Kasich has a group of people around him who are very experienced.
Absolutely.
And they are running a very low-profile campaign, but a good one in terms of strategy at this point.
And when reporters go to the Kasich people to talk about Fitzgerald and these problems he's having, how do they respond?
Typically, they say no comment. Typically, they turn it back to the Ohio Republican Party, which has usually been commenting on these situations. And Kasich himself at events, he only does what we call gaggles, where he meets with reporters and answers questions. Only occasionally. And often he will brush off political questions. That's politics. I'm not dealing with that right now. I'm dealing with these other things. So it really seems like the campaign is taking it. The dirty stuff goes to the party and the candidates are kind of taking things as they see them.
The high road.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Karen Kassler, thanks for joining me today to talk about it.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks.
We will continue our conversation about scandal in politics, what sticks, what doesn't, and why some emerge stronger for it, perhaps, or in spite of it. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Almost exactly 16 years ago, President Bill Clinton sat in front of a television camera and said this to the nation.
As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong. It constituted a critical lapse in judgment and a personal failure on my part, for which I am solely and completely responsible.
Later that year, the House Judiciary Committee proposed 4 articles of impeachment against the president, but he refused to resign and was ultimately acquitted. Now, he appears to be as popular as ever. Today, we're talking about political scandal, why some politicians survive them and how others are ruined. Joining me now by phone from the University of Houston is political scientist and an expert on political scandal, Brandon Rodinghouse. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Clinton is the most obvious example of a politician not only recovering from multiple scandals, but perhaps becoming stronger. The question is, was it because of them or in spite of them? What made the difference for him, do you think?
Well, it was probably a little bit of both. I think that the scandal certainly crystallized a sense in people that there are things that matter in politics that aren't just about scandal. And I think that people had to really look hard for why it is they appreciated the president's job. And that's something I think that the scandal allowed them to do. Had it not been for the scandal, it may have just been that we all enjoyed the prosperity and peace of the country, but didn't necessarily, maybe took it for granted. In this case, I think that the scandal helped to kind of crystallize the sense that that their president has multiple competing problems, and that if things are going well, it's probably for pretty good reason.
Did it necessarily make him stronger?
You know, I don't know if it made him stronger. I think it certainly, in the short run, hurt his opportunities to pass legislation. It hurt his sort of ability to negotiate with Congress. In the long run, though, I think it in some ways made him stronger because it demonstrated that there was sufficient political support to survive even something as earth-shattering as this kind of scandal. And so I think that it generated a kind of resolve in him and in the Democratic Party that gave him the opportunities in the longer term to be able to demonstrate that what he wanted and his vision for the country was preferred.
Right. He had support in Congress so that he could proceed with the policy.
Yes. And that's a big part of how presidents in particular survive these kinds of scandals. I mean, if it's the case that there's sufficient support in Congress for their activities and for their agenda, then Congress is more reluctant to try to make it a difficult process for the president. So partisanship is a major factor in this. And, you know, President Clinton governed at a time where we saw rising partisanship. And so because of that, I think that, you know, he really takes advantage in some ways of the ability of the system, especially his party, to coalesce around him and use that to his advantage.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about political scandal, who survives, who doesn't, and why. My guest right now, Brandon Rodinghouse, he's a political scientist and an expert on political scandal. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Getting back to the partisanship issue and the importance of it, is there a calculated risk on the part of, say, members of Congress who did support him after the scandals broke? You know, nowadays it seems like there's a rub-off factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. I think you definitely see members of Congress beginning to think very hard about their own re-elections, right? Most of them have a kind of short window for re-election and have to think about their future in the party as well as the future of the party. And so I think that they really do make these kinds of choices. What I found, though, is that most of the time, members of Congress of the president's party who were after the president has been accused of some kind of misdeed, they tend to rally around the president pretty seriously. In fact, I recall the moment after the Lewinsky scandal broke, you had members of the president's cabinet, many prominent Democrats, and many Democrats in the Senate and House came out and said that this is emphatically untrue, and this is just another part of this kind of grand conspiracy to try to get the president into hot water. And this is something that is ironic now, looking back, because obviously, it turns out that it was true and the president had, in fact, lied. But I think that that initial instinct among partisans to rally around a president, especially the president who at the time was fairly popular, is pretty stark. This also happens legislatively, too. I mean, once presidents are affected by these kinds of scandals, what I find is that in future transactions and future interactions with Congress, the party of the president tends to focus more and on the president's agenda and support the president's agenda more. The downside is that the opposite party tends to favor not favor the president as much. And so you have polarization, not only in a public level, but also from a congressional level.
So it's hard to even imagine what would happen if there was scandal associated with President Obama at this point.
That's right. I mean, now clearly is a much greater risk of polarization on virtually every single issue. And I think we see hints of this when we look at some of the things that the president has been accused of, and some of which are real, some of which are manufactured. But some of the IRS scandals and the Benghazi scandals, these things have become kind of this rallying cry amongst Republicans. And this is clearly just a tip of the iceberg on this. I mean, if it ever were the case that the president was involved in something real and dramatic that clearly linked him to some serious wrongdoing, then I think you would see just absolute bedlam in the political process.
Well, speaking of Benghazi and the IRS and that sort of thing, what constitutes scandal in terms of the research you do? How do you decide what qualifies?
This is a good question, because I think that, you know, oftentimes people are willing to throw the scandal mantra around a bit more than is probably warranted. For my research, a scandal is a specific wrongdoing that, if true, would be something that would be illegal. But I also include events that are of a sexual nature. So if there's adultery in question, then that I count as well, because it has such a specific place in American politics. There are non-scandals that exist that are usually on the order of what we might call a gaffe or a mistake. If a president, for instance, makes a remark that's offhand and perhaps, you know, off color, those kinds of things are lamentable, but don't necessarily rise to the level of scandal. What also is not scandal are policy decisions. And so if in some cases, if presidents make policy decisions that are something that become more complicated creates dissatisfaction, then that doesn't necessarily rise to the level of scandal. So for instance, the Abu Ghraib question, it's not a scandal in a sense that my research presents scandal. That's more of a policy choice. That said, these are questions which are debatable, and what constitutes a scandal could be simply what generates a lot of negative publicity. Mm-hmm. It's hard at some point to kind of make a clear distinction, but I think that for purposes of what presidents are concerned about, they're worried about real legal wrongdoing, and that legal wrongdoing is something that's hard for them to spin out of.
When I was growing up, and took the government classes and that sort of thing, I mean, the idea of impeachment was practically unthinkable. I mean, it was a really, really, really big deal, a bad thing. And President Clinton survived that. Now they're talking about bringing up articles of impeachment against President Obama. And I wonder if that's I what about that tactic?
Yeah, this is a really interesting development in American politics lately. And there's been, I think, probably too casual a talk about impeachment. And that's something I think which is damaging to the system at large, when it's no longer just the case that scandal is a kind of, you know, bare-knuckled kind of partisan tactic, right? I mean, the opportunity to catch your opponents in the middle of a scandal is something that has historically been very, very true, but has in the last, 30 to 40 years, especially since Watergate, been something that has been used as a kind of real partisan tool. Now, if impeachment as a kind of serious constitutional ramification is on the table now as part of this, then I think that the system begins to unravel in a really unfortunate way.
Jonathan from Columbus, you wanted to talk about Watergate. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Hi, thank you. As someone who lived through and followed Watergate very closely at the time, it seems to me that the media handles scandals, political scandals, much differently now than they used to in both investigation and covering them. I'd like to hear your guests speak to that a little bit.
Brandon Rodinghouse, thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, Watergate is certainly one of my favorite topics. Everything's a gate now, yeah. I mean, and Watergate really changes the game for American political scandal. And I think, to the caller's question, I mean, I think that this is certainly something that the media try to play on, and I'm not sure they're wrong, actually. I mean, I think that if you look at the history of Watergate, and if you look at the history of several scandals that directly involve a president, the common factor is that initially all of these presidents stonewalled. And that's something that I think makes people worried, that when presidents are involved in scandal or there's a hint that there's some wrongdoing, that they say that they weren't involved or didn't know or wasn't their issue, nobody believes them, right? And perhaps for good reason, because historically it's been the case that once the media and Congress begins to probe and delve into these with more detail, the president is in fact found to be involved in a more dramatic way. So that's, I think, something that is a real catch-22 for the political system. I think that people look at scandal and the public becomes disenchanted with the coverage very quickly. But at the same time, the media's job is to really probe these kinds of things and to make sure that there is some a resolution to this and that there is no actual harm that's been done to the system and that there's no law that's been broken. So I think the media are in a bit of a tough position because they want to give the public what they want, and yet they also need to sort of fulfill that watchdog role.
To what extent does the economic scenario play a role in survivability or demise?
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I think that the common wisdom is that economics and kind of positive economy really do make for a stronger case for survival of a politician in office. In work that I've done that looks at presidents and governors, I don't find any evidence that systematically that the economy really has a major factor. The biggest factor in surviving scandal tends to be the support of that member or that president or that governor in the legislature. And so that tends to be the most important. That said, there are times where the economy really does save a president. And one of the cases that we talked about earlier was the case of Bill Clinton during the Lewinsky scandal. And although I think the economy itself didn't necessarily save him, it was clearly the case that once confronted with the question of whether or not we should remove this president from office, the public couldn't help but think about the competence of the president, as some scholars have found, and really kind of put the scandal into the bigger context of what we expect from presidents. And so as a result, they tended to side more with keeping the president in office, despite the fact that he had done wrong and potentially broken the law. And so I think that the economy in some specific instances can be a real boon for presidents and for governors as they try to wiggle out of a scandal.
You study candidate survival after a scandal. And, we've been talking about Clinton a lot. That's one form of survival, obviously. Two terms, successful, very popular. Everybody wants him at their fundraiser, right? And then there's another kind of survival, I guess. Elliot Spitzer, I mean, he's not starving. He got a gig on TV. He did run for office and lost for the comptroller office in New York after being elected governor of the state. But what do you mean by survival?
Well, it isn't specifically for these kinds of studies. What I look at is whether or not the individual in question maintains their public office.
Okay.
That is, if they at the end of the non-survival is effectively being fired or being removed from office. So survival is just you get to keep your position. Your position is clearly wounded to some degree, even if you stay in office during your scandal. But for me, at least, the way to think about it is that the worst thing that can happen to you as a politician is that you're removed from office. But as you say, there is a redemptive vein in the American public, and I think that some of the kind of religious overtones of American politics that certainly has an effect here, where members of Congress or former governors or presidents can have a real redemptive moment, and it's happened quite a bit in the last couple of years. I think part of the reason it's happened is just because the public really has a short memory on these sorts of events, and I think initially they're shocked and horrified, but once they really start to examine and think about the big picture, that they tend to look past the issue or simply move on to a different issue. And so members of Congress or governors or presidents who were caught in these kinds of scandals can have a very quick redemptive moment where they may have some immediate problem that may have some effect on their term in office and may affect their ability to govern. But in the long run, these things tend to be pretty well forgotten about.
What about the topic of hypocrisy? Say one of the candidate or a politician who campaigns against gay marriage or gay rights, that kind of a thing, and then ends up being gay.
Yeah, this is actually really quite personal for me. In fact, I got interested in studying scandal because I lived in a city where the mayor, who was a very outspoken Republican on issues of gay rights, turned out to be somebody who had been accused of molesting children and had also been accused of being sort of closeted homosexual. And so this was really for me part of the way that I thought about how the irony of politics works, where the American public expects one kind of thing from their politician, and so often they get the opposite. So I think that narrative really plays well for the public, and that they see this and are kind of initially, horrified by this, and eventually these kinds of things fade. But I think that the interest in the kind of powerful media effect that scandals generate is clearly related to the phenomenon you mentioned in terms of the hypocrisy.
My guest is political scientist Brandon Rodinghouse from the University of Houston. If we're talking about political scandal, why some survive, why others don't, if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today about political scandal, why scandal ends some political careers while others seem to emerge if not unscathed, maybe even stronger. It took 150 years for Thomas Jefferson's affair with Sally Hemings to settle into public consciousness, but today things move a little bit faster. Everything a politician does can and will be used against him or her, like in this 2013 ad for Scott Stringer, who ran for state comptroller against Eliot Spitzer, who had resigned as New York governor after a prostitution scandal.
And he far outdistances Eliot Spitzer in integrity. Spitzer jailed people for prostitution and financial crimes. But when he got caught doing the very same thing, he held himself to a different standard and walked away scot-free. That's why the Times, Post, and Daily News all say the choice is clear. Scott Stringer, controller.
Spitzer lost that race against Stringer. Still with us is University of Houston political scientist Brandon Rodinghouse. Brandon, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
And joining us by phone now from Brunswick, Maine, is Bowdoin College professor and co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, Mike Franz. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is advertising like this ad against Eliot Spitzer effective, capitalizing on a well-known scandal? I already mentioned he lost, but were ads like this part of his problem?
Yeah, I think one of the things we know from the study of the effect of negative ads is that negativity is most effective when a candidate can pin their opponent on something that is considered by voters to be relevant to the choice at hand. So in that particular case, the integrity of Eliot Spitzer, his personal background, is a relevant characteristic for voters in making their decision. When a candidate can do something similar on a scandal that's either personal or policy related, and voters think that that's central to the decision that they have to make in that race, then it can be a very effective spot. The research suggests that when you attack a candidate on an issue or on a matter that isn't considered relevant, that might be sort of tangential to the job at hand, those effects or those ads have much weaker effects. So when a scandal pops up, that's prime material for a candidate to go after their opponent.
We were talking early on in the show about issues facing the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Ohio. The governor, who he's challenging for the office, isn't responding to requests or questions about that. The Ohio Republican Party and the Republican Governors Association, on the other hand, are airing ads that go after Ed Fitzgerald for his I'm not sure they raised to the level of scandal, but be that as it may, the negative issues. Does it matter where the message is coming from, Mike?
Yeah, well, it certainly can. The prevalence and ubiquity these days of outside spending is one of the key features of current campaign advertising. And one of the things that super PACs or other types of outside groups can do when they attack an opponent or enter a race is they can kind of provide air cover for their preferred candidate. So the candidate and the group by law cannot coordinate. So a group that goes on the attack can do a lot of the dirty work for a candidate, and the candidate can claim to have no affiliation with that group and can remain positive and can talk about the importance of civility and policy-related discussion. And so this is really a new feature of the campaign and advertising world, where we have this sort of division of labor that can emerge. And even though coordination can't happen legally, there's lots of ways that signals can be sent to the relevant players on either side of the aisle about sort of the issues or the sort of tone that would be appropriate for the different advertisers.
You know, Brandon Rodinghouse, you mentioned earlier that the electorate has a short memory, all things being equal. But, the digitization of media, it goes on forever, at least as far as we're concerned. How does that change the shelf life of a scandal?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think for sure that, political opponents can use these scandals to their great advantage and remind voters that there are reasons to vote against this particular candidate. And as Professor Franz said, these are the kinds of things that can be done from above and below and the side and from the shadows. And that's something I think that is fairly common for kind of modern politics. And it's clearly the case that these scandals can have an effect on re-election. I mean, looking at members of the House, you definitely see members who are involved in a scandal, especially those that were referred to the House Ethics Committee, were less likely to be re-elected than the members who were involved in some kind of wrongdoing that did not have their case referred. So the kind of formal process of sanction can have a dramatic effect on the ability of these members of Congress to survive.
Mike Franz, what's the role of media in helping to spread word of a scandal? A caller earlier brought up the issue of Watergate and that they thought that it really changed the media's role or clarified it in some way.
Yeah, I suppose that there's kind of a positive and negative to that. You know, the positive being that the media's watchdog role is clearly vital to the democratic process. On the other hand, there's now everyone wants to uncover the next great scandal, and so there's a push towards emphasizing these sorts of things, and sometimes they amount to significant scandals, and sometimes they don't. And the proliferation of partisan media and blogging and those attempts all make the sort of attack journalism more prevalent. And so and while, you know, holding candidates and incumbents' feet to the fire is in that sense good, it also creates sort of a rush to be the next great sort of investigative journalist. And that's, I think, emphasized even more so when it's interacted with the partisan media that exists today.
And that gets into the issue of what's a scandal, right, Brandon? I mean, I was from the generation that was propelled into the, you know, the journalism, the business of journalism because of Watergate. You know, that's a whole nother story and a whole nother show. But what I thought of as scandal at the time was something egregious like what President Nixon did. About the conspiracy that he was involved in, not whether or not he was having an affair.
That's right. I mean, I think that the standard for scandal is much lower now. Now, any kind of salacious picture you can generate or a kind of awkward video presents itself as a kind of problem for a politician. So it's not in some ways surprising, given the diversity of the ways that the media now can sort of get into your head. And I think it does look like the system sort of lurches from scandal to scandal because of this problem where there's always some kind of a new problem, some kind of a new video, and that, I think, creates this impression that this happens all the time. In reality, it doesn't. I mean, looking at the numbers, and if you really kind of pinpoint exactly, you know, what is a scandal, who's involved, how many people are involved, these tend to be kind of one-off situations where not much really happens. A person is involved in something that maybe was technically illegal, sometimes on purpose, sometimes on accident. It tends to involve very few people. Those people tend to be kind of quickly shown the door. And so in reality, I think that the impact of scandal is pretty modest. And so in general, that's the case. But at the same time, there are some cases where there are serious violations of law that have to be thought through and have to be really adjudicated. And so I think those are the ones that are important to focus on, as opposed to all the little, you know, smaller kind of scurrying scandals.
You know, it's interesting. We have the case of former Missouri Congressman Todd Akin, who made the insensitive and inaccurate comments about rape. And there's a question of whether or not the same speed of media that brought that out could also give him an opportunity to smooth things over and apologize quickly. Let's listen to this.
Rape is an evil act. I used the wrong words in the wrong way, and for that I apologize. As the father of two daughters, I want tough justice for predators. I have a compassionate heart for the victims of sexual assault, and I pray for them. The fact is, rape can lead to pregnancy. The truth is, rape has many victims. The mistake I made was in the words I said, not in the heart I hold. I ask for your forgiveness.
Did that help Akin or hurt him or neither, Mike Franz?
It was probably neither. He was in a tough spot regardless because of his original statements, and it's hard to justify or at least get yourself out of that. You're right that he was able to respond quickly put the ad up on the web as fast as he could, get it on TV as fast as he could. And that sort of forthright attempt to decide or to handle a scandal is in some cases probably a good approach. But sometimes because of the amount of chatter that can happen around this and because of the ways this can be scrutinized from all ends online and in the media, it's hard for a candidate in that kind of a situation to get out of it quickly and have the thing move on. This is the kind of thing that people are going to talk a lot about. And the apology, although absolutely necessary in this particular case for him, might not have been enough to inoculate him against the implications of his original statement.
We were talking earlier about lowering our standards for scandal, that things that, you know, we wouldn't have thought about 50 years ago become, you know, hot news in this day and age. Do we value scandal in general? Do people devalue scandal overall because of that? And also, as you mentioned, Mike Franz, the ubiquitousness of it.
Right. Well, without getting too much into the political psychology of things and just mostly kind of thinking about the way sort of the psyche of Americans are, I mean, I think we both love it and we both hate it. Oftentimes I'll find myself clicking on entertainment news before I do political news. That's probably a possible, terrible thing to admit. But and I think that, you know, when that sort of dimension creeps into the political side of things, as much as we talk about it, creating cynicism and disturbing our trust in government, at the same time we sort of crave it to some extent. And I don't want to go too far down that road, not being an expert in political psychology.
You know, for years covering politics, like I have, people complain why all the negative ads. Every year it comes up. It doesn't matter whether, you know, at what level I've covered it. And
right.
The answer always is, well, because it works.
Mm-hmm. Or at least the people who are making them think it works. So, and I think that's a major feature. Well, I think that there's a lot of the consultant class in the political world continues to think a lot of things work that the political scientists are investigating and may not think are as effective as they may be. I mean, the effectiveness of negative ads is not obvious, but I think that the people who create and craft those ads think that it is a little more effective. So you see that. Also, because there's so much chatter in the media about negativity, those ads get amplified. And so if you're trying to make your ad have more legs, you know, a positive ad of you with puppies in your family isn't going to get much media attention, but an attack on your opponent might work, but it also might generate some media attention. And so all those things create an incentive structure for you to air more negative ads. And also, just real quickly, as we mentioned, the amount of outside spending, they have no reason, or really, they don't exist to be positive entities. They're out there to be the attack dogs for the candidates that they like. And the more ads they air, the more negativity there is overall in the political environment.
We've talked mostly about white male politicians because they're the ones they're the majority in elective office and tend to commit or are caught up in scandal the most. But Brandon, there are racial differences in who's brought down by scandal, right?
There are some racial differences, I think, you know, people tend to have different opinions about who have punishment when they think about different racial backgrounds of individuals. That's something that is a new sort of line of research. You know, it's clear that, you know, although we've never had a female president, we've had several female governors, many of whom have been involved in similar kinds of scandals to their male counterparts. And so there are new dimensions to how scandal might work depending on the demography of the state and depending on the specific constituencies at risk.
What do you make of that, Mike Franz?
I think that's right, you know, and I think there's a lot more to be understood and studied about the sort of different dimensions of scandal and how it affects different types of candidates.
Yeah, and we're running out of time, but the fact is the vast majority are white male. Is that a problem when it comes to sampling and that sort of thing, Brandon?
Well, it is only in the sense that if you think about, depending on how you poll it, I think is really the problem. I mean, if you're talking about looking at a kind of a convenience sample, or if you're talking about looking at a kind of sort of ad hoc match sample, which some companies are doing now, it's a bit different. But a probability sample tends to be very representative if you do it correctly.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. Mike Franz, professor of government at Bowdoin College and co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Brandon Rodinghouse, a political scientist and expert on political scandal at the University of Houston. Brandon, thanks for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.